Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fregal Byrne. Every week I speak to leading sustainability thinkers and practitioners, scientists, economists, NGOs, business leaders and investors. We discuss the sustainability imperative, the key challenges, the latest thinking, and what's working in sustainability, resilience and regeneration. I'm very pleased to welcome Rob Hopkins to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. Rob is an activist and writer on environmental issues based in Totnes in Devon, England. He's best known as the founder of the Transition Movement, a community-driven approach to creating societies independent of fossil fuel, which he initiated in 2005. Hopkins has written four books on environmentalism and activism and is working on a new book on the environmental imagination. So thank you very much, Rob, for joining me today on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So, Rob, can you tell us a little bit about your background and what you do?
Do you know, that is always a question that if anyone asks me at a party what I do, is always just a bit of a, or is very, very hard to capture in a sort of a thing. So I'm Rob Hopkins. Hello. My background is I went to art school. I traveled around the place. I did one of the very first degrees, sustainability degrees. I spent a long time working in kind of practical sustainability, permaculture, teaching permaculture, learning and then teaching cob building, straw bale building, all that kind of building with local materials type of stuff. I set up the first two-year full-time permaculture course in the world at a college in Ireland. I then moved here to the UK and in 2005-2006 started something which became known as the Transition Movement, which is going to be the subject of what we're going to talk about mostly. And I'm currently writing and just finishing a book about imagination, which will be coming out this October.
Excellent. Well, maybe we can touch on that later on. That would be great. Yes. So maybe just before we dive into the transition towns, maybe can you tell me a little bit, I mean, you've been, as you say, at the forefront of this, you know, in terms of the permaculture movement and indeed transitioning towns. So you've seen some developments over this period. What's on your mind at the moment, and what worries you the most?
I think there are many things. I guess for me today, because it changes quite regularly, I think the thing that is really with me today is just the spectacular lack of imagination from the people who are at the helm at this point in history. You know, I just read Philip Hammond, who is the Chancellor of the Exchequer here, who said, well, we could get to zero carbon by 2050, but it would cost us £1 trillion. And that would mean we'd have less money to spend on police and schools and all these kind of things. And it's like, what are you talking about? How, if you wanted to recreate business as usual as we have at the moment with its accompanying inequalities and a loneliness epidemic and all of the stuff that happens now, and you wanted to recreate that in the future in a zero carbon way, then maybe. But actually, if you applied a bit of imagination and creativity and brought people together and looked at joined up solutions where you thought, actually, we can reimagine the NHS so that it's a well-being service and it's rooted in community and it's rooted in good food and conversation and culture and creativity. And you reimagine the police in a different way. And, you know, you see climate change as the opportunity to reimagine and rebuild everything. Then it's not going to cost £1 trillion. What are you even talking about? So I'm kind of with that at the moment, you know, that sense we are governed by people who exist in a world of extreme imaginative poverty, which is absolutely the last thing that we need right now.
Yes, and it's interesting you say that. I mean, it touches on a number of points, I guess, in the way that the debate in America and in, I guess, classical American fashion, they tend to present these ideas in financial terms, the possibilities of growth, as it were, the other side of the coin, the commodification of the climate crisis in some ways, which maybe we can touch on a little later. But I'm interested in this question of imagination and, I guess, ecological imagination, because I guess underlying, and we're going to talk about that in a minute, the transition movement is some sense of creating, a vision of the future in some sense. And I just wonder also, is that something that you think about a little bit in the sense that the narrative that we've had for so long, and which obviously is getting, the drumbeat is getting louder and louder in terms of just the sheer impact, environmental impact of, it will call it what you will, consumer capitalism and so forth, maybe with less focus on the kinds of alternatives and future visions of what they would look like. And so it's not just the government, but also maybe across the social spectrum and indeed environmental organisations and activists.
What, that we're seeing less imagination across those areas?
That this is something that I hear people talk about. They say, listen, you know, if you want to get change, you've got to stop, we scientists and environmentalists have had a kind of single tune for a very long time, which is, you know, the world is going to hell in a handbasket, we're about to be destroyed, it's going gone. And within that, there's less vision, less talk about what kinds of societies you would create, could create, what kind of initiatives. So what I'm saying is not just limited to the government, but maybe historically, an issue within the environmental movement. I'm just wondering whether you think that's got any validity.
Yes, I do think that we are living in a time where we are really, really short on positive, realistic, hopeful storytelling about the future that is still possible that we could create. And if we were to actually achieve what the UN says in the next 11 years, we have to cut emissions by half and be firmly on the way to zero. If we did that, and we were now 11 years in the future from now, we were looking back, how would that time have been? We weren't able to live through the civil rights movement. We weren't able to live through the suffragettes. We are able to live during the time of the climate emergency. And actually, I think to live through those 11 years where we hopefully saw the most extraordinary mobilization of people and communities and a reorientation of politics. We elected people who cared. People came in and removed the obstacles to this stuff happening. We saw a flourishing of a new economy, of doing energy in a different way. We saw a massive kind of push towards rewilding and an explosion of new kind of local food entrepreneurship, etc., etc., etc. I think it would be the most absolutely extraordinary time in history to live through. And if we start every conversation just by talking about how awful the future is going to be, we kill that stone dead. You know, Martin Luther King didn't stand up at the march in Washington in 1963 and say, I have a dream, but it's probably going to be a bit expensive and it might, you know, cause some disruption to commuters. And actually, it probably won't work anyway. I don't know what I was thinking of. Do you know, actually, we need to become so much better, I think, at really telling the stories about how absolutely phenomenal it would be to live through that time, to live in the kind of world that it's still possible that we could create. And, you know, the research about the power of putting those stories in front of us, I find fascinating. For this book, I interviewed two researchers at Plymouth University called John May and Jackie Andrade, who do this research about something they call functional imagery training, which is the idea that when people have obesity or addiction issues or something, and they want to make a change in their life, rather than just saying, okay, here's a plan, and work your way through this plan, they work with them to use their imagination in a multi-sensory way. So they might say, okay, imagine you're out running. You've been running for 6 months. You can do it. You're running in the sunshine. You can hear the bird song. You can feel the sunshine on your skin. Or, you know, imagine for the first time in the last 30 years, you're able to get down on your hands and knees and play with your grandchildren because you've lost enough weight and you've got yourself into shape. And to really hone that kind of mental image, that mental picture of what it would be like. And the results they have is extraordinary in terms of people. They call it creating new memories of the future. And it feels to me like we need to be working really hard to create memories of the future, which move us away from it's going to be awful. You know, I went to the Extinction Rebellion stuff in London, which I thought was extraordinary. And most of it I loved. And there was one thing that I thought, oh, dear, was they had these big banners that just said, we're fucked on them. I thought, I'm not sure about that messaging there. You know, I'd much rather. And actually what they did do was, for example, on Waterloo Bridge, you know, they transformed that bridge into a kind of living, breathing example of what the future could be like. Trees all down the middle and kitchen and library and people doing exercise and conversations. And it was just amazing. So, for me, and it's kind of the whole reason I've written this book, really, is because it feels to me like, you know, I see, particularly when I go to France and Belgium, but actually increasingly here, I meet a lot of people who are environmental activists. Quite often they might be transition activists as well, who have gone down this route of what in France and Belgium they call collapsology. People like Pablo Servigne, who've written books about, so saying, you know, collapse is inevitable. It's too late to do anything. You know, climate change is now completely irreversible. And actually what I see in people who kind of succumb to that stuff is they become really paralyzed. It's not the case for everybody, but I meet a lot of people who are kind of carrying a black stone around in their heart. And it feels like it's a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. While there is still a small window where we can do things, I think that the way we make that happen is by painting a picture of something that creates longing. I guess for me, longing feels like an increasingly important word. How do we help? How do we enable people to long for a low carbon future? So when politicians say, we'll cut emissions 80% by 2040, you can't long for that. That's just numbers on a piece of paper. You know, what would it be like? Tell me about it. What would it smell like? What would I have for breakfast in that future? What would we do? And so for me, a lot of what we try and do in transition is about telling those stories, but also to bring it alive in the present, to kind of give people a taste of it now, yeah, and bring it live for people in a very physical way.
Yeah, yeah. Very interesting. I mean, we'll touch on that hopefully at the end a little bit more on your book and some of those, you know, very interesting ideas. And yes, this collapsology. At the same time, I have spoken to some people who do feel that some kind of collapse, maybe not a global collapse, but, you know, social systems will change dramatically in food systems and other systems like that, which actually motivates them to get involved in local movements, localization, and I guess the kinds of ideas not very dissimilar from the transition movement. So maybe if you could talk a little bit about that, what is it? What's the goal here? And maybe give us a sense of the scope of you know, the transition today.
Yeah. So the idea of transition has always been about making the place. So we talk about transition as being a movement of communities who are reimagining and rebuilding the world, and the concept is really that. That when you look at it through, when you look at the community and the place around you through kind of transition lenses, if you like, there are loads of opportunities for bringing the economy home, I guess, in a way, and recreating it in a way that is about the idea of how you enable more money to stay locally and cycle locally, and you use that as the way to build connection and community and entrepreneurship and so on. So, you know, they're doing that in the city of Preston with an extraordinary kind of experiment there, where it's about reimagining how do you use the key organizations and institutions in the town to use their spending power to support local food production, local energy generation, a local cooperative, so that money stays locally. And it gives communities a lot more control over what they're going to do. Transition has always been about dreaming the kind of future that we would like to create. It's always been about conversation. So, for example, we did a big project here in Totnes called Transition Streets, which was a kind of a street by street behavior change model. So the idea was, how do you help people reduce their energy? You could just send them a DVD in the post. Or maybe actually what you do is you get them together with the neighbors on their street with a bit of facilitation and a simple guide, and they meet once every couple of weeks for 7 weeks. 1 week they look at water, 1 week they look at energy, and so on. And the thing that most fascinated me was we did this with 550 households in Totnes. And on average, each household cut its carbon footprint by about 1.3 tons, saved themselves £500-600 a year. But when the researchers went to everybody and said, what did you get out of being part of this? No one mentioned the money they saved. No one mentioned the CO2. Everybody talked about, I feel part of my street, I feel part of my community. You know, so actually, and that's what I see up and down the country with projects that transition groups do, where they are starting to put in place the infrastructure that a much lower carbon society would need, and actually finding that's the way that you bring people together. There are doctors' practices now who are starting to kind of bring in transition ideas, using that as a way of building a community around the practice, bringing the community into the practice. And I guess, you know, fundamental to transition is this idea that when we talk about a world that is able to stay below 1.5 degrees increase, that goes far beyond kind of business as usual, just with solar panels on the roof and some organic carrots. You know, it requires a really deep rethink of the scale that we do things on. And that in turn means, I think, that we need to be looking at how do we reimagine the economies of the places where we live. And there's my favorite example, actually, from the transition movement is in the city of Liège in Belgium, where I went 5 years ago, and Liège en Transition had started a project called Ceinture Alimentaire, which means food belt. And it had a really simple what if question, which was, what if in a generation's time, the majority of food eaten in Liège was grown on the land closest to Liège? And and then I went away. I went to a big event where they launched this idea and invited anyone who cared about food. I went back 4 years later, last spring, and they had started 21 new cooperatives. They had raised 5 million euros of investment from local people in order to support those co-ops into existence. They started 2 farms, 2 vineyards, a brewery, 3 shops in town. Just phenomenal. And I met the mayor of Liège, who said, this is now the story of this city. 8 years ago, we wanted to be a smart city. Now we want to be a transition city. And we see our role as being to remove whatever obstacles there are to this, and to help it however we can. We're making all our land available for people who want to become food growers as part of this. You know, and there I was one of the first places I really got a sense of, you know, wow, this is a strategy that will completely, that has the potential to transform this city in a way that actually is, yes, a step forward in every, at every moment. It's a, yes, public health strategy, yes, mental health strategy, biodiversity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that's fascinating, because I guess that's one of the I mean, maybe not untold stories to some extent of recent demographics, is just the extraordinary extent to which we're moving towards a more urban kind of lifestyle across the world. And I think that recently there was some research which showed that really underestimated just how big a phenomenon this urbanization is, and people moving to cities and the growth of the cities and so forth. And also increasingly movement on the ecological front as well, cities being, you know, having agency and being actors and taking the initiative. I guess you started, as I understand, in Kinsale and Totnes, and the ideas developed there, and is transition town, transition cities. Is that where the movement's going today? Can you give us a sense of what was some scope of the transition movement and the degree to which it's, you know, focused more on towns, focused more on cities?
Yeah, so we started in 2006 here in Totnes in Devon, really just trying to design something that might work here, with no idea of it being something that would go anywhere else particularly. And now in 2019 there are transition groups in 50 countries around the world, thousands of places. It's very much a kind of self-organizing approach. We always say to people, you know, you don't have to pay an annual membership fee to be a transition group. All the resources are free. Being part of the network is free. There's only one commitment, which is that you share your stories. So in many ways, it's a network of storytelling and people sharing and figuring that out. So I'd say when we initially designed the transition idea, it was designed as a detox for the affluent West, I guess. It was a model that was designed to work in the kind of wealthier Western nations. But it's very interesting to see how transition has been popping up in Brazil, Uruguay, Argentina, Chile, South Africa, all kinds of South Korea, in this beautiful sort of self-organizing kind of a way. It is generally... In big cities, transition doesn't work on a city scale. It's a strategy to work at the neighborhood scale. So in London, there are something like 50 transition groups across London, but Transition London only exists as a kind of loose network and kind of information sharing thing. You know, it's designed to work at that neighborhood scale. Actually, interestingly, which are often around the kind of size of Totnes. It's like there's something about a sort of market town kind of a size where people feel they have enough agency to try and change things.
Yes.
But also, you know, we're seeing lots of transition towns. We're seeing transition neighborhoods across cities. There are transition villages. There are many regional networks of transition groups. There are 24 countries now, I think, that have a national, what we call a hub. So like Transition Belgium, Transition France, a national organization which supports and networks those groups together. There are transition universities. There are some very interesting examples where transition is actually, particularly in France, actually, where mayors have a lot more power, where transition is actually led by very enlightened mayors. There's an amazing place called Ungersheim in France who are an extraordinary transition case study of what happens when the mayor watches a film about transition and goes, let's do that, all of that. And then, you know, a few years later, you go to a place where you see all the interconnections between food, energy, and, you know, that whole kind of thing together. An amazing town, a city near Dunkirk called Grand Sainte, where a mayor called Damien Carême as well was very inspired by transition and has done some extraordinary things there. And we now have a project which is called Municipalities in Transition, which is run by the Transition Network, which is about supporting and trying to bridge the interest from communities who are saying, come on, we need the support of our municipalities, and some places where there's people who are working very hard in municipalities who love transition. And they were trying to work out how they can build that bridge between local communities and local governments and how they can work together much, much more effectively.
Yep.
And then there are also places where there are people who are very actively involved in transition who decided, OK, if we're going to scale this stuff up, we need to run and become the government of this place. So you have local governments now made up of transition people. So it's working on all different levels.
And what would you say are some of the biggest learnings that you've had over? I mean, two or three things that you really think you've gained insight, and maybe to some extent that weren't obvious from the beginning, and maybe something that an aspect of it that you think you know that didn't work out quite so well, or and I'm quite interested in, and I think one or two people I spoke to around the question of localization had questions about local currencies and whether or not they were really viable or a good use of resources and so forth. Be interested in getting your experience of that. So yeah, I guess a few highs and lows in terms of, you know, insights and over the last 10-15 years.
Yeah, I would say one of the highs is that it's still here. Do you know, it's
yes.
Like actually, you know, you look at something like Occupy or the Nuit Debout movement in France, these things that sort of emerge with a big fanfare and then just sort of disappear again. You know, so that the fact that we were consciously able to kind of build a structure under this kind of the souffle to enable it to keep going feels like quite an achievement. The fact that this is a movement that has generated, we could just spend hours sitting here of just me saying, and here they did this, and here they did that, and here, you know, but actually all those different stories that this movement generates, I think are just phenomenal. I'd say some of the learnings are that it can be hard sometimes to sustain momentum over a long time. So there are some groups that just run out of steam because they get tired or they get exhausted or they all fall out with each other or whatever. You know, so there is a huge amount of effort that goes into the from Transition Network in terms of training people around this culture of having healthy groups. So groups are trained in how to run good meetings and make good decisions. And you know, that idea that how we do things matters as much as what we do is really, really central to the transition movement. I would say that sometimes shifting our thinking as groups from the idea that we can achieve the ambitions that transition groups have just with entirely volunteers is just nonsense. A group that meets once every other Wednesday evening and has a couple of hours to meet up is not going to achieve the complete reimagining of the economy of a place. You know, we have to find the thinking and the structures to create new energy companies, new food businesses, new networks to enable that to happen. And that's been a real shift in the transition movement. I think we call it the Reconomy Project, is that idea of giving communities the tools to start thinking about how they do that. And there are some great activities that come through that. In terms of local currencies, I think local currencies is one tool in the toolbox, I suppose. It's certainly not that you can't do transition without a local currency. It's something that some people have energy for and like to do. You know, we ran the Totnes pound here for 12 years, and then we just wound it down about 3 months ago because people just weren't really using cash anymore. And we saw that the circulation was falling, and we didn't want it to just sort of disappear with a fut, because actually we really loved it and it was a beautiful thing in this town and it meant a lot to a lot of people. And so we had a massive celebration party and really celebrated the life and times of the Totnes pound. There are other schemes like the Bristol pound, which is going well, and in France and Belgium, everywhere I go seems to have a local currency, who are doing some really interesting things that are changing the model and adapting the model from the way that we've done it here. So, you know, nobody knows how to do it yet. It's really like, I think Thomas Edison said something like, you know, I made 10,000 light bulbs before I made the first commercially viable one. Does that mean that all the 9,999 ones were failures? I would say they were all successes because they were what got me to this point of finding the light bulb that works, you know?
So
for me, you know, I there is something, we live in times that are very, very risk averse. And people are frightened to make themselves look stupid by trying things out that don't work. And in the transition movement, we have really no worry about saying, well, we tried that and it didn't work, and this is what we learned. And really encouraging people to just take risks and try things and learn from what's gone before and try something else.
Yes, very interesting. And you tied to this, I guess, is the question of finance and, I guess, business and the conventional ways in which business operates, is problematic, and the growth agenda associated with mainstream, I guess, corporate activity and so forth. I just wonder how successful you've been, or how you found it raising capital for different kind of ownership structures, for different models of maybe more social entrepreneurship, maybe co-ops, those kind of things. I mean, not one's expecting to, you know, I suppose you one might see one day a kind of a, not like a silicon hub, but a kind of transition hub in some sense of, you know, where a lot of new businesses are set up, maybe co-ops or, you know, but new organizations that, you know, to develop new ideas and also, yeah, to build the kind of a economy, a local economy in that way. How has that been?
Well, we I suppose in Totnes we have a small version of that, in that we have a place called the Reconomy Centre, which is an incubator for new enterprises, which was a very intentional shift in the way we did transition in the town here about 6 or 7 years ago, which was to say we need to build a new economy here, and how do we do that? So the Reconomy Centre is a like an incubator space. They every year they run an event, which is my favorite event of the year, called the Local Entrepreneur Forum, where four or five different people stand up and say, hello, my name is whatever, Rob, and I want to start a business doing whatever it is, and what I need is this, and they set out what their needs are and their offers for people to get involved, and they can be financial or they can be non-financial. They might say, I need £10,000, I need a work unit, I need someone who can make a website for me, and I need someone to advise me on tax or something. And then in the 400 people in the audience, someone will say, I'll invest £1,000 if three other people will, or I've got a building you can use, or, you know, it's amazing. This year's was the 8th time we've run it. More than 30 businesses have gone through it. Most of them are still going. It's raised over £100,000 of investment into those businesses and created a really dynamic network of businesses who've gone through it in the past. You go back every year to support the people who are then coming through and trying to find ways to collaborate with them. I'm involved with a social enterprise craft brewery that we started up, and we pitched the first year that it happened, and we found our investor through that, and we go back every year and identify one or two of the people who are pitching, and we do collaborative beers with them and find different ways to sort of work with them, and that's an idea that's kind of spreading out to other places, to different places. I think for me the big sort of shift in thinking for me was at the beginning when we started transition, I guess you could say that we were working with a sense of, as kind of environmentalists, community environmentalists, our sense was, what does this place need? This place needs to cut its carbon emissions, and we're going to find creative ways to do that. Now, the way I think about it is, what does this town feel it needs? And how can we meet those needs in a way that also kind of furthers transition? So in Totnes now, we have two projects, one of which is explicitly a transition project, and the other one that's had lots of overlaps with transition during its lifetime, which together are going to be building over 100 homes, which will be in community ownership forever, building workshop spaces, building a hotel, building a new space for public events. All of that stuff will be in community ownership and will generate funds going forward. So for me, it's really this idea of creating a new economy is something that's kind of becoming increasingly tangible here, and we're building these networks of people who are invested in different things. We have a kind of a community of older people now who come along to the left to the Local Entrepreneur Forum every year, and they identify things they want to invest in, and they think, well, you know, I could have my money in a pension, actually I can take some of it out and I can invest it in a whole range of different emergent local things. And if you know, a third of them go out of business, it's still okay, because I'm invested in these different things. But also I feel part of it. I can go along. I can volunteer with them. I feel involved in them.
Yes, it's
like impact investing that actually has an impact.
Yes, no, absolutely, absolutely. Do you ever, or do any of the transition team ever worry about the scale? And I just wonder, when you've got, you know, certain size units and things, you know, you're working at Totnes, do you think about this question, whether or not, you know, by putting together two or three different transition communities, you'd be able to serve at a sufficient scale? Or are you, you know, philosophically, are you very happy to have, you know, distributed, small, you know, employee, you know, involved kind of organizations? Is that part of what you're thinking is?
I don't think we are. I mean, if you look at, I suppose the example that would come to mind is in Bath. So Transition Bath and Transition Corsham came together to create a community energy company called Bath and West Community Energy, which has raised about £13 million of investment from people in and around Bath, which they felt they could do better working collaboratively in that way. But I think generally, yeah, for me, the model is small, local, diverse. You know, this brewery that I'm involved with, we're about to become a community benefit society to invite the community to buy the business. But our idea is really, there's a particular sort of scale we want to get to and then evolve in different ways and actually then become an incubator for new enterprises. Or, you know, David Fleming, who was a big kind of inspiration to me.
Yes, yes.
Who wrote an extraordinary book called Lean Logic. He was he was a real mentor of ours in the early days.
Really?
Oh, yeah. He used to say, it's not about silver bullets.
Yes.
It's about silver buckshot.
Yes.
Which I really liked. You know, that we're not looking for one thing. We're looking for a whole dazzling diversity of ideas and possibilities and things that are very, very place specific.
Yes, yes. You know, that's a very interesting. Yeah.
Lots of things that I go and see projects, whether they're businesses or projects that transition groups have started, which is like, firstly, no one in Whitehall would have thought of this idea in a million years. And secondly, this would only really work here. There are elements of it you could take somewhere else, but the fundamentals of this work here, and that's beautiful, because, you know, like in Black Isle in Scotland, which is a peninsula there, they got funding from the Scottish government to do a project called the Million Miles Project, which was to reduce the amount of car use by a million miles a year, and because the people who ran it were local people from that place, they knew everybody, they understood the place, they were able to work in a way that someone coming from the Scottish government with a clipboard and a big pot of money would never have been able to do. And they actually ended up reducing car use on this peninsula, the equivalent to driving to the moon and back 2.5 times, by promoting cycling, walking, car sharing and stuff like that. But it's because they were from that place.
Yes, brilliant, brilliant. I guess what emerges as well, and you're talking about shifts in thinking, is that you have this systemic view, I guess, of a transition, we should call it a transition community, a transition town, the kinds of different elements that are, you know, part of a system that nourish each other and that are synergistic, I guess, in a sense. I mean, could you talk a little bit maybe about what a systems perspective, you know, what insights you might have had from that, or just how you include that in the way you think about things?
Well, I guess to come back to when I was talking earlier on about Philip Hammond in the news today saying, oh, it'll cost £1 trillion to stay below, to get down to zero carbon by 2050. You know, well, yeah, if you think in a completely linear, stupid kind of a way, but actually, if you start thinking, okay, let's reimagine the National Health Service. I visited an extraordinary place in France a few weeks ago called Montsartu, which is a town where about 5 years ago, the French government introduced a rule to say that 20% of food in French schools should be organic. And the municipality in this town went, well, if 20% is better for our kids than 0%, then why are we stopping at 20%? Why don't we just go for 100%? So they now have a thing where 100% of the food in all the schools in this town is organic, and 70% of it is grown on a commercial market garden on the edge of the town on a 7-hectare site, which the municipality bought, which was going to be developed for housing, and they turned it into this beautiful market garden with polytunnels and orchards and bees everywhere, just phenomenal place. And I went there, it was a few weeks ago, I was walking around, and I found it really emotional, because for me it was, you know, I've spent the last 12 years going around and basically with this vision in my head of this place, of something like this, talking to people about this and trying to help them to, and now I'm in it and I can see it and I can smell it and I can talk to the people who are doing the weeding here, and I went to the school and I had lunch with the kids, and actually I'm looking at this, I'm thinking, this is a win-win-win-win-win-win-win solution here. You know, this is something which, by applying a bit of imagination to it, is giving people space to breathe in their lives. It's giving the kids healthier food. What they found was fascinating was that after they introduced this policy, 13% of families in the school said they now buy all organic food, and 60% of families who previously said they never bought any organic food now buy some. You know, so there was a culture shift going on because the municipality had taken that bold step to say, let's do this. You know, so I'm thinking, okay, if that works here, imagine if we're saying in every city, the hospitals do the same thing. And hospitals are surrounded by market gardens. They use their grounds for growing food. They team up with land on the edge of the town. They see growing food for the hospital and the hospital spending its money on food as a key public health strategy to get people active, to get people back into work again. It's a key biodiversity strategy for the town. There's this beautiful thing in London called London, the National Park City, about reimagining London as a national park. You know, well, that can run through the economic approach for the city. You're looking at strategies which are a mental health strategy, a public health strategy, ending the epidemic of loneliness, getting people together, the massive anxiety crisis among young people in particular, but across society. You know, that there is a way of managing all of this if we can bring imaginative thinking to it and rethinking everything, that is not going to cost £1 trillion and would just be. That is the thing for me, is that it is tantalizingly in reach, and I have this privilege of going around to visit places where it's already happening. It's not, there's nothing here that we have to fly to Mars to collect some magic stone.
And is this, in your experience, I mean, how broad based is the participation? I mean, sometimes some of these, you know, organic initiatives you come across in London are, you know, the food is very pricey. It's a very middle class, particular kind of group of people who are, you know, interested and supported. To what extent is it your experience that you're getting, you know, a wider social mix, more people involved? And I guess also linked to that is the, you know, is the financial implications. You know, you talk about these amazing, you know, local food and organic food initiatives. And yet, you know, for a significant proportion of the community, and particularly in the UK, you know, food prices are a real issue.
Yeah. So then the question for me then is kind of, we're asking the wrong question. It's not why is it that middle class people can afford organic food. It's why is it that we consider it acceptable for so many people in this population to have no choice other than to eat shit food, and then to be happy to spend masses of public money on then addressing the public health crisis that arises from that. But actually, you can't interfere with the fact that people can only afford to eat crap food, because that's all about choice in the free market. You know, so when I went to that place in that town in France, it wasn't like just the middle class kids in the school were eating organic food. It was for everybody, you know, and actually we have to look at the fact that that system whereby so many people have no choice other than to eat really a really poor diet is not an issue of choice. It's a lack of choice. It creates huge problems down the line, and it shouldn't be like that. You know, so of course, initially, when you are starting new food-based businesses which are trying to do something differently, it's more expensive because all the subsidies go in a particular direction, because all of the externalities of producing the food in that way are passed on to the public to clean up all the mess, including the public health epidemic. So again, if Philip Hammond, to come back to our friend Philip Hammond again, had any kind of imagination, it's like you don't look at the public health crisis and the way that families feed themselves as somehow being separate from each other. You know, we have to look at this, join this up, look at it holistically, look at it systemically, and say everybody in this country has a right to eat a diet which keeps them healthy. Everybody in this country should have a right to an education which enables their imagination to flourish, not be snuffed out by the age of six. Everybody in this country deserves somewhere to live. Everybody in this country has a right to, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And actually, yes, there's a beautiful movement called Universal Basic Assets,
which is kind of goes beyond the idea of universal basic income and says everybody has a right to a good education, public transport, a clean air, you know. And for me, there's something about if we move towards this idea of universal basic assets, we can still do really extraordinary things.
Now, I'm mindful of the time, Rob, and I would like to talk about your book. I'm just wondering, get a sense. I mean, in recent months, in the last year or so, certainly the last 6 months, there seems to be tremendous momentum in terms of, awareness and indeed action about the climate crisis, about the environmental crisis. There's, not just Extinction Rebellion, but Greta Thunberg. And, you know, I think even in America, where there's been an extremely polarized opinion, you know, the climate is on people's minds. They're seeing what's happening. So there does seem to be a groundswell. You've got AOC in Congress. You've got the Green New Deal. So in a way, it almost seems like the debate has moved quite quickly from, you know, is it happening or not? And now there's, you know, a lot of question about, you know, what are we going to do and so forth. And it seemed in a way that the transition movement is, it was always a step, the next step, because people, you know, you had to understand there was a crisis in the first place before you even start to think about, you know, why you'd need to do something about it or want to do something about it. And I'm just wondering what you think the changing climate means for transition and what your vision really is over the next few years.
I feel like, as somebody who's been doing this for 12 or 13 years, I kind of feel like the reinforcements have arrived somehow. It feels like the cavalry have arrived from wherever. And I've been on all the school strike, just sort of going along to support the school strikes in Exeter, which is the city near where I live. They're absolutely extraordinary, and I find it so emotional. Being on the school strikes, being around the school strikes, it's just fabulous. And my wife was very active in the Extinction Rebellion, 2 weeks of rebellion up in London. She was got arrested twice, and I went up for some bits of those, and I just thought it was amazing how in that short period of time the debate, how much more seriously the debate was taken. In the first day, the media was all, oh, everyone's late for work, isn't this terrible? Second day, they had Kevin Anderson on the radio and all the people on there talking about, no, this is really serious. This is why this is happening. David Attenborough's thing came out, you know, and then all the places declaring a climate emergency. It feels to me like transition for a long time has been like the carrot. You know, it's been based around this narrative of, we could create something amazing here. Let's get started. Let's do it now. What we haven't had so much has been the stick. That has said, you need to sort this out. This is not acceptable anymore, and I'm going to super glue myself to your house until you actually do something. For me, it feels like something. Feels to me like the tectonic plates underneath all of this stuff are starting to shift in the last few months in a way that feels absolutely fascinating. And so I'm really, really hopeful that the Extinction Rebellion and the school strikes are a beautiful, bold, loud, imaginative no, and they need to be accompanied by a beautiful, bold, imaginative, loud yes. And I think when we get those two things together, then I think we'll start to see things move very quickly.
Right. Fascinating, and very optimistic. What about your book? Very briefly, I'm mindful of the time. Talking about this question of the imagination, what's the book called, and what are a few of the interesting insights you've had? Because I guess for you, it's been a journey as well in terms of discovery and research.
I've spent the last 2 years working on it, and what I realized the other day was I interviewed over 100 people for it, and I'd only heard of about 25% of them when I started the book. So it's been a real kind of journey. It's called From What Is to What If, Unleashing the Imagination to Create the Future We Want. It's going to be published by Chelsea Green Publishing in October. And in essence, it came around because I found myself reading people like Naomi Klein and Bill McKibben and George Monbiot and people I really respect, who kept saying climate change is a failure of the imagination. And then they would go off onto something else, and I was left there going, that was really interesting. What did you mean? What was that all about? And then I read some really interesting research from about 2011, where this researcher argued that we were seeing a decline in our imagination since the mid-1990s through this American creativity test that she had a big data set of. And so it set me off on this question of, are we as imaginative as we used to be? I think in many ways, climate change is the logical, gruesome outcome of Margaret Thatcher saying there is no alternative. And of course there's an alternative. There has to be an alternative. Our survival depends on there being an alternative. And my concern is that we are at a time that demands us to be as imaginative as we can possibly be. And we're in a time where our imagination is not up to it. It's kind of in this perfect storm of an epidemic of anxiety which shrinks the imagination, social media and the technologies that sort of suck our attention and our imagination away somewhere else, a whole range of different things. So the book is a kind of an exploration about, are we living in a time of imaginative crisis? And if we are, why? And what might we do about it? So it includes, visits to all kinds of fascinating projects who are really putting the imagination first and asking, what if? We talked to the local government in the city of Bologna, who have created a civic imagination office as part of how they run the city. The mayor of Mexico, who's created a ministry of imagination. It asks, what would it look like if we created a national imagination act? To really fire up the imagination across the country, how would that work? So it takes a kind of a lateral approach to the challenge that we face and says, we need to create a culture where anything feels possible. What would it be like to live in a time when anything felt possible and school produced young people whose imaginations were like a superpower and the organizations that we worked in valued our ideas and our imagination? And so I'm hopeful that it will fit in really beautifully with the debates going on now around what do we do next, to say actually we need to be creating the ideal conditions in which the human imagination can flourish, because without it, we end up like Philip Hammond, and then we're all sunk.
Bringing it back to Philip. And where are you with that? Are you nearly finished the book?
Yeah, it's finished. It's just being laid out and designed at the moment, and it'll be coming out in October.
Right. Well, fantastic. And I will make sure to publicise and send share information with listeners and so forth when that happens. But thank you so much, Rob, for joining me today and talking about all the great work that you've done and great insights and ideas, and very inspiring. So I wish you the best.
My pleasure. Thanks. And thank you for doing your podcast. It's a great contribution to everything.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. It would be great if you could leave a review and share the podcast on social media. You can sign up at iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.